TED Audio Collective.
Hello, I'm Chris Anderson. Welcome to the TED Interview, the podcast series where I get to dive much deeper into a speaker's ideas than is possible during their short TED Talk. The ideas we hear at TED often have significant implication for the way we live and how our societies are structured. I sometimes wish we could see our leaders putting those ideas to work more often. Today's guest is doing that and more. Michael Tubbs is the mayor of his hometown, Stockton, California, and at 29 years old, is the youngest mayor in the country governing a city of over 100,000 citizens. The Stockton Mayor Tubbs grew up in had high crime and poverty rates, and after the Great Recession, it was the largest city in the country to declare bankruptcy. When he first became involved in city politics, he understood that the first step would be to face up to the roots of those problems.
And then I realized that in many ways, Stockton and our society has been structured for the outcomes we complain about, that we should not be surprised when we see that kids in poverty don't do well in school, that we should not be surprised to see wealth gaps and by race and ethnicity. We should not be surprised to see income pay disparities between genders, because that's what our society historically has been structured to do, and it's working accordingly.
Today on the show, I'm going to talk with Mayor Tubbs about his fascinating journey into public office, some of his bold initiatives to battle poverty and crime in Stockton, like piloting a universal basic income plan, and his thoughts on how to overcome the deep division we see in America today. Mayor Michael Tubbs, welcome to the TED interview.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I guess about 2.5 years ago, you took on one of the hardest jobs in America, to be mayor of a city of, 300,000 people, and not just any city, Stockton. Stockton was rated by Forbes magazine, I think 9 years ago, as one of the three worst places to live in America, for goodness sake. Could you start, Michael, by telling us some of the challenges recently faced by Stockton?
Well, absolutely. I'm born and raised in Stockton, California. It's home. And growing up, I remember writing my college essays about the article you mentioned. And when I decided to run for city council in 2012, the city had just declared bankruptcy, the largest municipality at that point in time to do so, and had a rocketing crime rate with more homicides per capita than Chicago. Growing up in Stockton was definitely a challenge, but one that I didn't realize was challenging or not normative till I went to Stanford.
Tell us about your own childhood. What was that like?
So my mother, she had me as a teenager. I was 1 year old when she crossed the stage as a high school graduate. And my father has been incarcerated for my entire life, including when I was born. He was in the juvenile detention facility, and he was 16 as well. So growing up in poverty, we lived in neighborhoods that even to this day we're focused on as one of our focus areas and zones, areas of low opportunity and really concentrated poverty. So I remember hearing gunshots at night. I remember being hungry and eating things like grilled cheese from government cheese for dinner. I remember my mom and my family doing their best. So I was able to go to private school for 3rd through 6th grade. But because of tuition, I wasn't able to pay for uniform. So I would have to sometimes wear my girl cousin's polos. with the ruffles on it. But I also remember how loved I felt. I never felt insecure. I never felt terribly anxious. Despite the real challenges, I felt really loved. I think that's in part to my mom, my aunt, and grandmother for really sort of instilling in me a set of values, but also instilling in me a real sense of possibility.
Mm. Say a bit more about the values that you grew up with.
Yeah, well, I'll start with my mother, who had me incredibly young, but now owns 2 houses. Works incredibly hard, and she's not a big speech giver. She's not an orator. She would never be called. She should be asked to give some sort of talk, but that's just not her scene. She's a doer. So I learned so much from her example. I learned from her the importance of speaking up and standing your ground. She taught me just to the value of hard work and determination. There's one story when I was a sophomore in high school, and we were preparing her for her job interview to get a promotion, which we really needed. So I remember going online and Googling like top 10 interview questions and sitting down with my mom and figuring out how do we answer these questions in a way that would get us this promotion. And from my 15-year-old vantage point, she was killing it. So I was excited, went to bed, said some prayers. And then the next day I came home and I heard her crying in her room. My mom doesn't usually cry that often, so I knew something was terribly wrong. So I went back there and I was like, well, mom, what happened? And she explained how she was denied the promotion, not because she couldn't do the job. In fact, someone she had trained received the job, but because she didn't have her AA degree. And I remember feeling really guilty in that moment. I was like, well, if you made the choice not to have me, you would have been able to go to school, maybe. And as I apologized, she stopped me and she said, don't you dare apologize. And then she said something that really motivates me and sticks with me to this day. She said, do not allow yourself to be limited. If someone tells you no, they did tell you no because you can't do it. Not because you don't have a certification, not because you don't have a degree, not because you make sure you have every single thing that you need. That let nothing or no one limit you. And that's what really gave me a passion for education, but also a passion for understanding that a lot of the limits we have are self-imposed.
And how about your grandmother?
So from my grandmother, I learned the value of faith and service. I used to go to church with her every single Sunday and every single Wednesday for Bible study. And just hearing some of the values of our faith around justice, around this ethos of love, and around this ethos of transformation and second chances, and really about kind of purpose that she would always say, like, Michael, you're here for a reason. You weren't an accident. There's something that's going to come from all of this. You just stay focused.
Well, they were right in seeing that potential, I guess, because, I mean, you got a scholarship to Stanford. How were those years?
Stanford was an amazing 4 years. I met my wife there. I met many of my best friends now, and I also kind of met potential there as well. Because I think, particularly growing up in an urban environment, oftentimes it's not cool to stand out. Like, you stand out too much, you could become a target. So when I got to Stanford, I realized that, oh, wow, I could be me. I could be fully me. I can show how much I know or how much I want to learn. And it was the first place in my life I had been in that didn't operate from a scarcity mindset. Like, there was always enough. There was always enough grants. There was always enough food. There was always enough to do everything that needed to be done. And it was also where I learned that talent and intellect are evenly distributed and universal, but oftentimes resources and opportunities aren't. I would sit in classes, and yes, my classmates were smart, but there were some folks I grew up with who I played these just as smart. And if they had gone to prep school, or if they had had private tutors, or if they had gone to a great public school, maybe they would have been at Stanford as well. So it really exposed me to that, but it also exposed me to what a special opportunity I had as someone who comes from poverty to now be in a seat of privilege and to be equally comfortable and be able to speak in both worlds.
I mean, that's a pretty amazing set of events that happened there. You know, we like to think that America is this place that is, you know, upwardly mobile, that there's the American dream, that anyone who's got talent and the willingness to work hard can kind of do whatever they want. Yeah, in some ways, what I hear you saying is that you were there at Stanford as more of an exception. You know, it's actually a rarer story than we would like to think.
Yeah, and what's interesting, Chris, is that I remember going into Stanford, I felt so special because, like, the American dream is real. Look at me, I made it. And then while studying and asking critical questions, I realized your point that, yes, I made it, but it's so special because it is exceptional. And that's why it's called exceptionalism, meaning that it's above the norm. That's not supposed to happen. And then I really became passionate with this idea of how much talent are we wasting? How much genius is hidden because of the ways systems and structures are currently operating? So I think this idea of American meritocracy is a powerful one. And I know it's been true for me, but I read somewhere that we have less income mobility in America than in most developed countries. That if you're born poor or born in poverty in America, you're more likely to stay there than move up.
Yeah, indeed. In your TED Talk, Michael, you described how, you know, you were interning at the White House, I guess in the Obama administration. And then you had a phone call, which really changed your plans, changed your destiny. At one point, you've said that you planned really not to go back to Stockton. You know, you were out. You were going to, I don't know, get involved in the world. And then you had this phone call. Talk about that and what happened next.
Yeah, so my junior year in college, I had just completed an internship at Google. I was in the White House working in intergovernmental affairs, and my job was to work with mayors and councils under senior advisor Valerie Jarrett. And I loved the opportunity, but actually hated the job. I was like, all these mayors, all these councils, okay. But I was learning so much about what people were doing at the local level. And I was like, this is interesting. We need good people to run for local government. But at that time, I had no intention of coming back to Stockton aside from like holidays and things of that sort. But I didn't see myself going back and making my life there. And I thought maybe I would do management consulting. Or maybe I would teach in some other community and do education policy. But I thought it would always be at a national or state level. I never just thought Stockton would be the destination, particularly because when I grew up, so much of the narrative was that to be successful meant you left. And all the folks who came back or who stayed in Stockton, that means something was wrong with them. Like they weren't as smart or they didn't work as hard, et cetera. So that was kind of the dangerous ideas I had internalized. But that all changed when on November 1st, my mom called me. And my mom, she's very active with communications. But when I was in the White House, she wouldn't call because she respected President Obama so much. So she would email or text me, but she would never call to distract me from work. So when she called, I knew something was happening. So I remember answering, and she met me on the other end. I could hear sadness, and I could hear her crying. So I was like, oh my gosh, what happened now? And then she recounted to me that my cousin, Donnell James II, had been murdered at a house party in Stockton the night before. And I remember my heart just dropping. And actually, I couldn't believe it. I was like, wait, what? And I remember going back to my desk and feeling really removed and disconnected from the conversation that was being had. And it was like right before the election. It was November 1st. So people were talking about how the Dems were going to lose the House. And everyone was so angsty about that. And I was just like, this is so far removed from my day-to-day. Like, my cousin was just murdered. I don't care about this conversation. So I remember being very angry. And then I remember feeling almost powerless. Like, what was the point of trying to serve or trying to make things better? Maybe it's just best to just do what I can to be successful for me and my family. So over the course of several months, actually, I was depressed, angry, upset, confused. I felt this real sense of survivor's guilt. And then I think after speaking at my cousin's funeral, and I saw all the pain and all the hurt, and I was like, well, I get to catch a flight tomorrow and I'm back in D.C. But all these folks are still here. And that's when the thought began to germinate in my mind that maybe one day I would come back to Stockton and run for office just for a little bit as my paying it forward, paying it back. And then my next year, my senior year, I was applying for all these fellowships and things and nothing seemed to be working out. Like things I was supposed to get just didn't happen. Like before interviews, I would just get in a weird mood and just not show up, which was not the norm for me. So my mom was really worried and my mentors were worried, like, what's going on? Like, you don't just not show up. Like, what? And I was like, I don't know, you guys. I'm not feeling it. So make a longer story short, in December, I was back home with everyone pressuring me. What are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? What are you going to do next? My senior year. And then one of my friends and colleagues came up to me and said, well, how many more people have to die before you feel ready to come back to your city and serve? And that was an aha moment because I had not shared with anyone I was even thinking about running at that time. And when he said that, I took that as confirmation. So the next week, I gathered people in my mom's living room and said, hey, you guys, what do you think about if we ran for city council? They said, if we ran, who is we? I was like, well, if I ran, but representing all you guys. And that's where the campaign was born.
Yeah, that's amazing. And your age right then was what, like 22?
I was 21.
21. Okay. And you were successful in that campaign. At that time, did you have like a clear platform that was effective, that was the reason why you got elected?
Honestly, probably not. I think the backdrop of when I was running, we spent a lot of time knocking on doors and talking to people. And what I found was that so much of the conversation in the city was dominated by this narrative of municipal bankruptcy. By the doorsteps, people were telling me, like, no, the city has been morally and leadership bankrupt for a long time. And then also on the doorstep, I would see people get excited by my age because it represented, like, hope. Like, the next generation is not giving up. It's not fleeing. They're coming back to fix it. And I want my kids to have the same experiences that he had.
So let's roll the clock forward 4 or 5 years. You're serving as councilman. And then there's the opportunity to run for mayor. I mean, you're still ridiculously young at this point. There's no mayor of any American city as big as Stockton remotely that young. What were you thinking? Why did you think you could do this?
Well, in my 4 years at city council, I learned that my age was an asset and that there were some skills I had that had nothing to do with my age. Like, I was real, like, everyone wanted to talk to me. Every different, even warring constituency groups would come to me and say, Tubbs, can you help us mediate this dispute? And when businesses would come in, they would ask to meet with me and not the former mayor. They'd be like, is Councilman Tubbs available? But then two different constituency groups approached me about running. And I thought, if I have these folks' support, there's a path to win. The first was the head of the business council, a group of business organizations in the city. And a dear friend of mine, Jane Butterfield. She said, I think you should run. I said, okay, if I have the business community behind me, I was 25 at the time, this 25-year-old black guy, maybe we have something here. And then the police chief approached me and said, I would appreciate it if you considered running for mayor. And I said, I have the police chief and the business community wanting the 25-year-old black guy to run. There's something here. If I get those two groups, I could get all the other folks in the coalition.
This is really surprising that the way this unfolded. Was it genuinely a surprise to you that they would come forward and say, you should run? What did they see in you?
But I think they really saw leadership. I think they saw a special moment in the city's history. They saw, I mean, over the 4 years, I had to lead on very tough votes. I had to build coalitions. I was able to work with the community to open up a bank in my district and close down a liquor store and open up a health clinic. Like, there was a track record of getting things done and also a willingness to take hard stances, to say no, to say we can't do this now, but also to challenge us. And I think because Stockton is so diverse, historically, it's been so polarized. It's been this group and like the constituency groups that I'm able to bring together haven't really worked together as a unit. Before. So I think for a lot of them, they saw an opportunity to bring the south part and the north part of the city together. And I think also, they also saw like the future for their city in a sense. Like, well, wow, we've tried it this way. Let's see if he can help lead us in a different direction.
Talk just a bit more about the city. I mean, you referred there to the north part and the south part. Just describe the difference between them.
Yeah, so Stockton, California, similar to most American cities, and due to the legacy of redlining and white flight, we have historically a dichotomy between the north part of the city and the south part of the city. So right now in Stockton, poverty is concentrated not just in the south, but there's pockets of poverty throughout the city, and there's mass discrepancies between zip codes. So between 95205 and 95219 zip codes, there's a 10-year difference in life expectancy. There's a 50,000-year difference in household income. There's a 15% difference in unemployment. And these areas are only 8 minutes away from each other. There's no freeway. They're literally 8 minutes away and have a 10-year difference in life expectancy. And I think not just in Stockton, but throughout this country, that's a legacy we have to confront and do what we can to even the playing field as much as we can. So a lot of those discrepancies like that, the way history is haunting our present, really influences a lot of the work we're doing now with me as mayor.
In the TED Talk you gave this year, you took this Bible story. I mean, it actually honestly shocked me when you first started talking it, because it's a story I've heard like dozens of times in my youth. And my first reaction was, wait a sec, you can't have a Bible story in a TED Talk? And so it was the story of the Good Samaritan. But you turned it into a really beautiful sort of modern interpretation of it. You made the plea that we have to learn to be neighbors to each other in a better way. And then you also talked about structure, that the solution was to be a neighbor, but also to reimagine that road and how to change it.
So looking at the story, I realized that the road, Jericho Road, has a nickname. It's known as the Bloody Pass, because the road is structured for violence. This Jericho Road is narrow, it's conducive for ambushing, meaning a man on the side of the road wasn't abnormal, wasn't strange. And in fact, it was something that was structured to happen. It was supposed to happen.
I guess I'd like to ask first, like, just as you look like on the structure question, what are the two biggest things, let's say, that you would just love to see changed that would fundamentally change the prospects for citizens?
The longer view would be, number one, just equitable education funding, not equal. Understanding that students who start with less may need more in terms of credential teachers, in terms of resources. Like, because right now it's unequal, which is crazy, but even having equal school funding wouldn't be enough. Like, we might have to compensate for some gaps. So I think, like, even just if not a complete 360, a flip, so it's more equitable. So we understand that students in communities of high poverty probably need the best schools to counteract poverty would be a huge way of restructuring our roads. I think number two, we're already paying for the impacts of unaddressed trauma and violence, et cetera. And a lot of the causes seem to be poverty. So just abolishing poverty, number two, would be a huge step to restructuring the road to one that we could all be proud of.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
You're growing a business and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate, no coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
In many ways, Michael, I think, you know, people look out at the country today and at many countries outside the US and see, you know, this dismaying dysfunction, divide. People, you see communities that are stagnant and are fearful of the future. And, you know, there's a lot of people, I think, have almost given up hope at the possibility of fixing some of these issues and actually saying, nope, we have issues, but we can move forward. I think part of why so many people are excited by you and the story is the possibility that, you know, you have discovered some ways in which it is possible to move forward and that there may be lessons, you know, that others can take. And so I guess I would just like you to talk through some of the things you saw, some of the things that you've tried, I don't know where you think is a good place to start. Do you want to start with just even like the crime situation? What happened there? What your thoughts are? I know it's a work in progress. Talk about that.
Yeah. So on violent crime, it's the reason why I decided to run for office in the first place. So it's something I take very, very personally. And what we've done is really, again, as I mentioned in the TED Talk, really extending this idea of neighbors to everyone in our community, including those who cause harm and should be held accountable for their choices, but also understanding that those choices are made in the context of trauma, of unsafe environments, and of being harmed themselves. So when I was on city council, I campaigned to help create this Office of Violence Prevention, which looks at sort of the data around who's driving our violent crime, and realizing that in a city of 320,000 people, it's less than 1% of our population that commits gun violence, or 80% of our gun violence, and kind of changing the public narratives to say we need to do everything that we can to focus on these guys and get them help, because these guys have been arrested on average 8 times, the majority of them on probation and parole, being that they're no strangers to incarceration and to law enforcement, and that hasn't been enough of a deterrent. So then when I became mayor, I decided to add on to that strategy with another strategy called Advanced Peace. So now there's 14 people on our streets doing the gun violence deterrence work.
So it's a pretty radical approach, this. I guess Advanced Peace is the name of the strategy, to not just wait for crime to happen, but to identify people who you believe are at risk of perpetrating crime, and then trying to understand them and give them an alternative way forward. Is that the right way to describe it?
Yeah, absolutely. And also the Advanced Peace model, because it's not in city government, it's a lot more flexible, a lot more community-driven. They're able to do things like take their fellows on trips, fellows meaning people identified for being at risk for gun violence, take them on trips to expose them to a different world, connecting them to opportunity. Then after 6 months, they're eligible to be part of a fellowship where they're given a cash stipend for their job, which is to continue to do well, to kind of help with community events and planning. So those are our two strategies. And last year, we saw a 40% reduction in homicides, which is exciting. But this year, we're trending back up, which is a reminder to me that our work isn't finished. But in terms of what's worked, I think number one, sticking my neck out and really having a difficult conversation about the need to love these guys who many would consider unlovable, and to kind of humanize them. Number two, having everyone see our collective responsibility, because these guys just weren't parachuted from elsewhere. They went to our schools, they go to our churches, they went to our rec centers, and something along the way, on the road to bad choices, there were things that family did and didn't do, which they should be held responsible, but there's also things community didn't do. So that's kind of been what's working and what hasn't worked on the crime front in Stockton.
And what do you say to people who, you know, the critique of this plan is that, you know, you're paying people not to commit crimes, would be the criticism of it. What do you say to that?
Absolutely. I think as we start from the premise that number one, crime is costly, that we pay for it already. That for every homicide, it's about $500,000 between systems in terms of cost. So that we're paying it, it's very expensive. It hasn't even measured the impacts of trauma, et cetera. And then number two, I mean, I start almost any intervention or any program with an analysis of the status quo. And the status quo is just untenable.
So somehow, Michael, you have been able to attract to Stockton some wildly innovative programs, really funded by, in many cases, by philanthropic money from coming in from outside the city. I'd love you to talk a bit about them because they raise so many interesting issues. Maybe just talk first about the scholarship fund that you have going there.
Yeah, so we have a scholarship program called the Stockton Scholars, which was seeded by a $20 million donation from the Spiegel Family Fund. And with that $20 million donation, we're able to make the commitment to every single graduating senior from our largest school district that if they graduate high school and go to a four-year school, they're given $1,000 a year for 4 years. If they go to a trade school, they're given $500 a year for 2 years. And if they go to a community college, they're given $500 a year for 2 years. And that's super important for Stockton because currently we're number 98th of the top 100 metro areas in terms of adults with a four-year degree or higher, with only 17%. Concurrently, we're having a conversation with the governor's office about putting the next Cal State University in Stockton, as we're the largest area in the state and the second largest in the nation without one public institution of higher learning. So the Stockton Scholars Program is important because, number one, it signals expectation, that we expect you to do something after you graduate high school that leads to a family wage job or in a career. And then number two, it's personal because I know for me, being the first one in my family to go to college, being supported by very generous scholarships, what made it easier for me to come to service, made it easier for me to come back to Stockton. And my goal is to make every single Stockton student feel a sense of belonging or a sense of indebtedness to their city for funding, helping fund their education, that they feel the need to come back for a year or 2 years or to come back and settle here and make it their career.
So is there a science part of this? I mean, is part of the purpose here to show that if someone makes that investment in these kids, that it really pays off within a few years by allowing them that extra education?
Yeah, absolutely. I think every mayor in every city is focused on economic development. And the conversations I've had with CEOs and others has been, okay, where's my workforce? And how good are the schools? Where's my workforce? How good are the schools? So I think for any city, boosting the education levels and the higher education completion of your residents is an economic development strategy. It's about making sure your workforce is future ready. It also helps improve the quality of your schools because now the school district has responded in making sure that they're teaching and elevating standards so that all our kids graduate ready for the gift. And even if you can't find philanthropic sources, it's not $20 million a year. It's $20 million over 10 years. So it's really about $2 million a year. And municipalities, governments, et cetera, can find that amount as we spend millions of dollars on other things on an ongoing basis that don't have nearly the potential rate of a return on investment.
So part of your hope here is to prove that that investment is just a really smart investment for any city to make.
Absolutely. And I think for me, I want this in perpetuity. So over the next several years, we'll have a conversation in the city about how do we fund this after the 10 years, because it's that important.
Hmm. Talk about another program that you've got going on there that has attracted headlines and that, at least in some people's views, is a sort of an early stage trial of what could be a huge idea for the future, namely universal basic income.
Yeah, so in Stockton, we're piloting a guaranteed income through a program called the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration, or SEED. But essentially, we see that I believe the crux of most of our issues in Stockton is poverty. And also, but in this country, it's not just folks who are in poverty who are struggling. 1 in 2 Americans can't afford one $400 emergency. There's people working 2 or 3 jobs and still not able to pay for necessities. And I think we have to have a conversation in this country about how do we make sure the economy works for everyone. And at the very bare minimum, people have an income floor so the bottom doesn't come out from under them. So in that vein, we decided to launch a basic income demonstration where 130 families over the next 18 months are given $500 a month with no strings attached through a debit card. And what we've seen, we started in February, and we've already seen interesting results. We've heard from folks like Tomas, who is a supervisor at a logistics company, who talks about how the $500 a month is enough for him to sit at the table at dinner, because he doesn't have to work at night anymore because he has that extra income. Or just yesterday, we heard from a mother who thanked the program for the extra $500 a month because it allowed her to meet the gap to pay for her child's braces. There's another older woman who talked about how before she was selected for the program, her utilities were going to be cut off because she didn't have $330. And thanks to that $500 the first month, her lights are on. They seemingly are using this money for things that are not luxuries, but necessities. And there's 320,000 other people in my city who probably, not much less in this country, who could probably benefit from said investment. So it's been an exciting pilot. I've leaned in on this particularly because I think I'm more wedded to the question, how do we abolish poverty in this country? And I think a guaranteed income gets us a long way towards that goal. But I'm also excited to see after 18 months what the evaluation plays out for us in terms of does this work, et cetera.
Obviously, to run any experiment like this becomes hugely expensive. So I'm curious about several things, Michael. Like, what, number one is, has there been resentment from other people in the city at the way this was rolled out?
Yeah, there's a lot. There's some resentment. I think some of it is that, again, a lot of people are struggling. And what I found interesting is that there's this interesting resentment around the other, as if they always get benefits. They always get help. What about me? And a lot of that's actually racialized. So there's a lot of resentment because there's the idea. They see me. I'm a black mayor. They hear basic income. They assume every recipient is black. I mean, that really and it really kind of brings up biases around, what about me? No one sees me. They get all the help. What about me? Even though that's not the case, our sample is actually representative of the city, which has black people, but also white people and Asian people, Latino people. I think there's also resentment because Stockton has a lot of challenges. And I think some people, it's easy to be upset and be like, oh my gosh, the mayor thinks the issues to all these problems is giving people $500 a month or giving 130 people $500 a month. So we've been spending a lot of time telling people like this may get the most attention, but this is not the only thing we're doing. We're doing a million things at once, and this is part of it. But we walk and chew gum. Like we could do this and other things. I think there's also a lot of resentment just towards me. Being a political figure, you're never going to get 100% consensus. So I think a lot of resentment is like, oh, look at this young mayor trying all these crazy ideas. Like he needs to stick to his job of picking up trash, which again goes back to the idea that we can do both things at the same time. And we can pick up all the trash in the world, but our biggest impact and legacy will be if we help solve answer a question of national significance. So we'll continue to do both.
The criticism that a lot of people make is that any payment like this runs the risk of just increasing dependency, that you know, by a lot of people in America and a lot of people around the world only want to pay people if they work. That's what payment should be for. And they already resent, you know, welfare payments of any kinds. They feel like they are, you know, just creating dependency and getting in the way of people doing what they need to do to contribute to the city. Have you run into that criticism, and how would you answer that?
Well, absolutely. And actually, a lot of those were some of the questions I had even when we rolled out the program. Like, I came into this not as a believer, but as a skeptic and saying, will this work? Let's see. But I think on the point of work, what I found and what research tells us is that the majority of people who can work do work. But the issue is that there's so many people who are working, but wages haven't kept up with inflation. That folks are working themselves literally to death or to opioid crises, and still can't pay for necessities. So I think for me, I come for basic income as an addendum to work, not a replacement for work. And I think particularly in our economy, women perform all type of things that are, if they did it for somebody else, would be considered work that they aren't compensated for. I'm thinking about things like child rearing, domestic work, caregiving, et cetera. And I think there was just some report that said in the majority of U.S. cities, folks who work minimum wage can't afford an apartment. So I think for me, the criticisms don't really hold up around the weight of actually what's actually happening in the day-to-day people's lives. And something as small, particularly as $500 a month, isn't enough to replace work. No one can live off $6,000 a year. And I think that's why other people are calling for much more ambitious proposals. But given the resources we had, we figured $500 a month would be enough to start to show that even something as small as that can make a meaningful difference.
Is there a legitimate role for philanthropy in the way that cities are run to allow this type of experiment? Some people would say that, you know, because you're charismatic, because you're an amazing story, that you've been able to attract philanthropic interest and that other places in the country couldn't possibly do this. Is that too negative a view? Or do you think others actually, if they ask the right questions and put the right possibilities on the table, they actually could attract private money to contribute to a city's welfare?
Absolutely. And I think that if you look at per capita what Stockton receives in philanthropic support compared to San Francisco, LA, Oakland, Detroit, it's laughable. We're not even in the same conversation in league. I think the difference has been we've steered our philanthropy to very important big questions that have big impact, that makes it look like they're larger investments than what other communities are seeing and have seen historically. But I do think, so if there's any philanthropist listening, we could use more in Stockton for sure. We have a good partner in me. But to the writer point about philanthropy, I think particularly in times of austerity, with pensions costs looming and cities having to do less and less with more need, that philanthropy has a very important role to play to kind of help catalyze one-time things, to help pilot and test ideas that then can become policies for scale.
Michael, I'd love to get a picture of you in action, and especially in handling, you know, some of the more sensitive issues that you're potentially running against. So give me a story of an interaction you've had recently with, I'm going to say, someone from the richer part of the city who's worried about some of the changes that you're bringing in and isn't sure what to make of you. Do you have a story that you can tell of how you have communicated your vision to someone like that?
Absolutely. So the most recent example was a week ago. I had a fundraiser. I assumed everyone there was a supporter, but ostensibly some people weren't. So afterwards, they came up to me and they were talking about, hey, like, I'm hearing this stuff about free money, and I saw it on Fox News that you're doing this stuff. Like, I don't think that's good for the city. And I usually start by asking questions. I usually start by saying, well, what do you know about the program? And I hear what they think. I'm like, well, what do you think are solutions for? I get it. But for me, I'm more interested in the problem. Like, this is the problem we're trying to solve. People are working all these jobs in Stockton. They can't pay rent. You hate homelessness. I hate homelessness. I hate poverty as well. So how do we, what can we do? And I kind of hear their ideas. And then I say, well, have those ideas been tried before? Because usually they're things that, like, education and jobs, which are important. And I'm like, well, what's the harm in trying this? Like, what will happen? What's the worst that can happen? Then I usually have to assure them that we're also doing these other things you care about. We brought in said company to provide these jobs. We're doing this on education. So this is not, all our eggs are in this basket. It's just an extra basket we have. And even if they walk away still not believers, they feel heard, listened to, and they at least understand that there's some thoughtfulness behind what it is we're trying to do. And that's generally a conversation I have to have around violence or the basic income or housing and homelessness, like, at least once a day.
Hmm. So paint a picture, Michael, about what you would love Stockton to become. I mean, do you have in your mind a 5-year view, a 10-year view, or a 20-year view of where this city is going?
It's going to sound flippant, but I mean it. I want Stockton to be a community where everyone listening to this podcast wants to live in, meaning it's a community that's safe. It's a community with opportunity. It's a community with nice amenities. It's a community with diversity. It's a community that's a real community, meaning people know each other and that there's a civic life. It's a community with opportunities for folks to stay if they want to. It's a community with a university that's public and a private one. And it's a community that's informed by this ethos of love. It's not a utopia. It has people, so it's messy and there's conflict sometimes. But it's a community where folks can afford to live in. It's a community that understands, again, the need to really be true to values, particularly around the worth of every person. And it's a community that's always trying to solve problems, that collaborates, that disagrees, but figures out how to get to a solution. That's kind of the community I'm fighting for. That's the community I think we deserve. And that's the community, my goal is to put us on that trajectory by the time I'm done as mayor.
And maybe some magazine or website in 10 or 20 years' time writes that article saying how Stockton is one of the three coolest, most dynamic places in America to live. Go move there.
Absolutely.
Finally, I think I'm going to say, well, pretty much finally, when you look at America more broadly and you see all the division that's out there, I mean, does this idea of what it is to be a neighbor, it's almost a religious idea, but there's a lot of faith in America's history and America's soul, I would say. Do you think this idea could play out more broadly? What would you say to the rest of America to give us some hope?
Yeah, well, I'm young, but I do study history. And I was surprised to learn there's a time in American history where folks were like dueling each other in the Senate, like literally shooting each other in the Senate. Or there's a time where the country was literally at war, where brothers were fighting against brothers in the Civil War. So, I mean, partisanship today is bad, but it's also been part of the American story that sometimes we disagree, unfortunately, historically, violently, about sort of who we are and what our values are. But the beautiful part is the values of justice and equality prevail every time. And I think particularly for this moment in our country, we have to be reminded of, like, what's good about who we are as Americans. And what's good about us is we don't always get it right. History tells us that, but we always find a way to start to correct it. Even if it's painful, even if it hurts, even if we just coast kicking and screaming, we find a way to give women the right to vote. We find a way to ban lynchings and to abolish slavery. We find a way to end school segregation. And we find a way through courageous conversations and sacrifices of people, and we see that kind of democracy being reawoken now. And I think on this tip of being a neighbor, that democracy only works if we're neighbors. Like, the only way our fragile, pluralistic, diverse, grand democratic experiment works is that we look at each other as different and see what's the same and celebrate the things that are different. And again, that's hard work, but that's the work that's not on the president. It's not on Congress. It's on each and every one of us to do that. And then I think the last thing is probably the most painful thing. But as a country, we really have to reckon with the ways in which our past informs our present so it doesn't contaminate our future. That we have to literally reckon with and reconcile with the fact that our country was founded and rooted in many ways on Native American genocide and white supremacy. And it's painful, it's not cute, it doesn't feel good to say, but we have to reckon with that fact so that we can correct it today so that 20 years, 30, 40, 50 years from now, we don't have what we see reflected in terms of our highest national leadership, which is a part of America, which speaks to a certain sensibility, a certain ideology, and a certain feeling of supremacy, but also a certain feeling of otherness is bad. That difference is bad. That if we were all the same, if we did things like we used to do 60 years ago, if we just erased and marginalized certain people or stopped people from coming in or tear people from their parents or deny agency to women, then we would be better. And that's just not America. That's just not democratic. But we have the power and the agency to change it. And we've done it before. So I'm confident we'll do it again.
Michael, when you feel like you've given what you can to the city of Stockton, is there a possibility of a broader role in politics for you at some point in the future?
Yeah, so if I run and win re-election in 2020, then I'm termed out in 2024. And I would have spent 12 years in local government, and I'll be 34 years old. And then I think if I was to do anything politically, it would have to be something at a state level, if not federal. But I also think there's ways to influence and work on these issues I care about outside of government. So I could see myself either in government or running a large advocacy organization. I just know for a fact, no matter what I do, I'll be really focused on this question of how do we change the structures so that they're more reflective of our values. And I think that's something I'm going to dedicate the rest of my life to doing and then pass it off to the next generation when the time comes.
What's one final takeaway you'll give listeners to this podcast? What would you like to inject into their minds?
And the last takeaway I would say is that Alice Walker talks about the easiest way we give up power is to think we have none. And I think we surrender so much of our agency to what feels like the bigness of our problems. But I'm a hopeless romantic. I'm literally in love with possibility. I'm in love with what can be. I think we'll get better. And I know it won't just happen because I say it, but we have to do the work. But I meet so many people, I'm sure just like the people listening to this podcast, that care deeply about living in a democratic society that really allows for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for everyone, and are willing to do the work to make it happen. So I'm happy to be a partner in those efforts.
Mayor Michael Tubbs, thank you for these words. It's been a treat to speak with you. I really wish you the best as you try to secure this vision.
Thank you so much, Chris, for the therapy. I mean, the podcast talk we just did.
Michael Tubbs is the mayor of Stockton, California. Keep an eye on this man. And if you liked what you heard today, why not share this episode with anyone you know who's interested in the future of civic life? Also, make sure you catch Mayor Tubbs' full TED Talk at TED.com. Meanwhile, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us what you think of the show by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Those reviews are influential, actually. We certainly read every word. I'm Chris Anderson. Thanks for listening. This week's show was produced by Lacey Roberts at Transmitter Media. Our production manager is Roxanne High-Lash. Our show is mixed by David Herman. Our theme music by Alison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to my colleague, Michelle Quint. And thank you for listening. On our next episode, economist Kate Raworth, the creator of what she calls donut economics. It's a model that prioritizes the health of our planet over profits.
In our economies, for some reason, we think that endless growth is progress. And yes, I think that we are now running into severe problems because we are addicted to endless growth.
PRX.